Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
Welcome, everyone, to the Thursday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Jim Garrity on vacation this week. Daniel Foster of National Review Online here in his place. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Dan got a decision from the Supreme Court today. No, it's not about Obamacare. No, it's not about the Arizona immigration law, but it's still good news. And we're always happy to hear good news, especially when it means SEIU has lost. Yes, it's about the labor unions, and specifically, quoting now from the AP, the Supreme Court ruled Thursday that unions must give non-members an immediate chance to object to unexpected fee increases or special assessments that all workers are required to pay in closed shop situations. Specifically, the court ruled for Diane Knox and other members of the SEIU's Local 1000 who wanted to object and opt out of a $12 million special assessment the union required from its California public sector members for political campaigning. Knox and others said the union did not give them a legally required notice that the increase was coming. So this doesn't go as far as a lot of people would like. Obviously, the bigger issue is being able to use those dues for campaigning in general, but at least it's a step in the right direction, and it means that these things can't be foisted upon workers at a moment's notice just because their favorite political cronies need a little help.
Yeah, it's definitely good news, I think, for right-to-work sort of advocates and things like that, and it seems like a very sensible limit on union power. I haven't had a chance to read the decision yet. I think that the actual substance of it is a narrower decision, but with all the concurring opinions thrown in, it was a 7-2 decision.
Right.
And it was only Breyer who tortured everybody gathered at the Supreme Court this morning by insisting on reading his dissent when people still didn't know if the next opinion was going to be on Obamacare. So he's sitting there, you know, dusting off his glasses, reading his dissent while everybody's waiting to hear if there's going to be an Obamacare decision. But, you know, that's gotta dig a little bit at SEIU especially, is that you had President Obama's first Supreme Court appointment voting with the majority in this case. And I definitely think it's good news. You're right. It's a small board victory by all accounts, but it's a step in the right direction. And it's another kind of blow against union hegemony that we're seeing being done, I think, a better way legislatively. We're seeing it being done at the state level, but this is a welcome addition to it.
Yeah, we'll take it. Just to dive into the quotes a little bit here, Alito wrote the majority opinion saying when a public sector union imposes a special assessment or dues increase, the union must provide a fresh notice and may not exact any funds from non-members without their affirmative consent. Sotomayor said when a public sector union imposes a special assessment intended to fund solely political lobbying efforts, the First Amendment requires that the union provide non-members an opportunity to opt out of the contribution. And Breyer said if the union's basic administrative system does not violate the Constitution, then how could its special assessment have done so? But as we mentioned, 7-2. In favor of the majority opinion, obviously.
Yeah, and I think the narrower majority, the one that actually says that the First Amendment requires, I'm paraphrasing off the cuff, but I think the narrow majority said the First Amendment requires an opt-out, which would be pretty strong language and a foundation for future rulings, you know, broadening that right to opt-out of union dues.
Not a good month for the SEIU.
In fact, no, sir.
For Wisconsin, and that's a good martini that I think both of us will drink, too. On to martini number two now, and Dan, this is not a very horrible martini. It's just a questionable martini, and that's the rumor mill that's going on right now in terms of Mitt Romney's search for a running mate. Originally, ABC reported that Marco Rubio is not being vetted. Mitt Romney had to go out there and say, actually, yes, he is. So we don't know that a lot of these rumors are based in a ton of facts, but the name that's out there right now is rapidly rising up the charts is former Minnesota Governor Tim Pawlenty, which obviously Romney could do a whole lot worse. Pawlenty did a decent job in a blue state. He would certainly be effective in helping Romney on a number of policies. But the reason this is sort of the bad martini today is because of what Pawlenty doesn't bring to the table. He clearly didn't energize people with his presidential campaign. And the thing that bugs me even more about this possible idea is that you need the number two to kind of be your pit bull. Romney's going to be the nice guy talking about how much better the economy will be under more favorable conditions for the free market and the private sector and so forth. And so you need somebody to be lobbing the Molotov cocktails at the other side. And this is the guy who wouldn't go after Mitt Romney on Obamacare just one day after using that term on a Sunday morning chat show, wouldn't use it in a debate. And the fact that he used it at all means the Democrats can throw that back in Romney's face potentially. So I think there's perhaps more drawbacks than pluses here.
But, Greg, the fact that he wouldn't go after Romney on Obamacare is probably the reason why we're talking about it today as a potential VP pick. Yeah, I mean, I have mixed feelings about this as well. You can certainly make the case that given a few chances to electrify the country early on in the campaign, Pawlenty failed to do so in a pretty major way. And I do think that his whole campaign strategy in the very early part of the primary, since he seemed to drop out the day after he announced, was to bring all of the reasonable and calm and boring features of Romney's appeal to kind of centrist and the center right, and to kind of split the difference between Romney and folks like Michelle Bachmann. That was his strategy early on. But I have to say, you know, we were talking as the primary. Dragged on, and we quickly forget this stuff. We were all, you know, all of us in the commentariat, especially on the right, were saying, as the non-Romneys were dropping like flies, we were saying, man, imagine if Pawlenty had just stuck around. Would this have been his moment? Could he have done what Santorum, failed to do there at, you know, in the home stretch? So I don't think that we should write him out completely. And also keep in mind that he is a blue-collar guy with a blue-collar story, and he comes from what I very lovingly refer to as the sausage belt. Can't hurt to have another guy from that region who has some working class credentials. Might at least, you know, make it close. I don't know if he's gonna swing Minnesota, but I wouldn't be devastated. And I'm generally a supporter of, you know, what you would call the double vanilla theory of how Romney should select a running mate. I'm a Bob Portman guy. I want Portman, who's even more boring than Pawlenty. But I love Portman. I think he's incredibly competent. He's strong on fiscal issues, good on social issues. He can work across the aisle but not compromise his principles. I'm a big cheerleader for Portman.
Well, he's certainly been a name listed in the top tier, given his executive branch experience as well as all his time in Congress. So we'll see which one eventually gets picked here in the next few weeks. My theory is that he wants to reach out to the base just a little bit. I don't think he's got to win him over to vote for him, but he might need to fire him up to do a ton of work to help him out. Although,
so go on record. Do you think it's Jindal? Who do you think is the Rubio? I don't think it's going to be Rubio.
I don't think it's going to be Rubio. I think Jindal's stock is very quietly rising just because of everything he's been able to accomplish in Louisiana. But I think the appeal of somebody in the Midwest, like you mentioned with Pawlenty or Portman, is going to be out there as well, because a lot of critical electoral votes are there, and one person might be able to help him snag a couple of states that might just be out of reach otherwise. But perhaps we're giving a little too much credence to the vice presidential role here. The main issue is don't hurt the ticket, and I think potentially both of those guys can accomplish that. The guessing game continues, and I guess as long as Obama keeps doing what he's been doing the last couple of weeks, motivation for the right probably won't be much of a problem come November in the fall campaign. But one of the things Obama will have in his corner is the mainstream media, of course. And one of the things we talked about yesterday, Dan, is that given this executive privilege claim and the resulting contempt of Congress citation voted out by the House Oversight Committee, it's going to be pretty hard for the mainstream media to keep ignoring this story. It was pointed out, I guess, by Charles Krauthammer and a couple of other people that NBC News prior to yesterday had spent 10 seconds on the story. I'm not sure how you spend only 10 seconds on a story, but that's the factoid. And well, as predicted, they had to talk about it yesterday. But listen to how Brian Williams pretended like this story had been on his radar screen, yet at the same time, he knows almost nothing about it. It's pretty fascinating.
Just tonight, a House committee voted to hold President Obama's Attorney General, Eric Holder, in contempt of Congress for refusing to turn over documents related to a badly botched sting operation involving guns and drugs in Mexico called Fast and Furious. This contempt vote comes after the Obama White House, for the first time, invoked executive privilege. Charges of stonewalling and cover-ups are flying, the kind of stuff we first learned during the Watergate era. And for those not following the complexities of all of it, it just looks like more of our broken politics and vicious fights now out in the open.
Well, one of the reasons you might not be following the complexities of the case is because NBC hasn't talked about it until today. So if you find yourself in the dark, NBC News viewers, that's probably why. Dan?
Yeah, it's always fun to see the media caught a little flat-footed on something like this, that events have overtaken the narrative, and they kind of have to cover it now, like we talked about in the last couple of days. So you see Williams, and I actually like, as a guy, I like Brian Williams just fine. I don't think he's as good as a guy like Jake Tapper in the mainstream media at playing it right down the middle. I think he's got a little bit of a liberal bias, but he's an affable enough fellow. But what you see what Williams does here is he defaults immediately to the this is part of the nasty partisan infighting in Washington aspect of this contempt vote, rather than doing any reporting on the details that led to the contempt vote. That, you know, he says, oh, charges of stonewalling. Well, no, you can do reporting on it. I mean, there was stonewalling. Holder exhausted every option available to him to not turn over these documents until he was finally forced to ask President Obama to invoke executive privilege, thus reversing this administration's very loud and very empty heretofore position on government transparency and openness. So, I mean, there's a real story here, and I think you're seeing MSNBC, see how my mind slips, you're seeing NBC there really caught flat-footed, and they're going to have to report this out, and they're going to have to get more into depth about it as it continues to be an issue. So, you know, I think you're going to see them filling the blanks in a little more just because they're forced to.
Kudos once again to ISA and the committee for demanding what should have been turned over months and months and months ago. And of course, now they're being painted as the bad guys in all of this as just more partisan hackery. But if you look at the details, it's pretty clear that there need to be answers here, given the fact that law enforcement personnel have died, Brian Terry specifically, and that there just hasn't been cooperation with a co-equal branch of the government. So, Dan, we'll see where it goes from here. Thanks, as always, for your time. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Thanks, Greg.
Daniel Foster is news editor at National Review Online. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Please join us on Friday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.